He's Jim Browdy.
And she's Marjorie Egan.
And this is Boston Public Radio.
89.7 WGBH, WGBH HD1 Boston.
Online at WGBHnews.org.
Boston's local NPR. Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. We all know Newton's first law of motion. A body at rest stays at rest. A body wearing a Fitbit stays in motion. Anybody who wears a Fitbit understands how it propels you to take the next step, climb the next staircase, run the extra mile. It's benign, even healthful tyranny. It's so powerful, the Fitbit has survived mighty competitors, at least so far, like the Apple Watch. Fitbit was off to a running start, went public a couple of weeks ago. It's one of the few companies gone public this year that can say it's turning a profit. But for all its popularity and its loyal users, my daughter being one, can the one-hit wonder company sustain its momentum? Somebody else is wearing one in the studio, too. Here with us in Studio 3 is the wearer, Nancy Kane. Nancy's an historian at the Harvard Business School, where she holds James E. Robison Chair of Business Administration. Her latest book, but not for long, is Ernest Shackleton, Exploring Leadership.
God
Nancy,
bless you.
Great to see you. Hey, can I ask a question before you even start
Go
with
ahead.
The Fitbit thing? How many nanoseconds before there's a case study at the Harvard Business School on Boston 2024?
Oh, I'm sure there's already one being formulated as we speak. I'm sure that they were already writing one, and now it's going to be a very different case than it would have been, you know, 2 days ago.
But it's going to happen, right? It's
I'm sure. I have no private or public knowledge about this, but I have no doubt that one of my colleagues with other, you know, with good researchers is going to write
Can't wait.
About this, because it's about leadership and mobilizing coalitions and ultimately the failure of you know, Boston 2024 to get this off the ground before too much time
Can't
had passed.
Wait.
You know, you're a big equestrian. Are you happy about this or sad about it?
Oh, I think it's – as an equestrian, as a citizen, I think this is ultimately the right thing for the big picture of Boston and
too.
For sports competition around horses in Boston. The proposal they had for the riding competition made none of us in the horse world very happy. So
really?
Yeah.
I did not know that.
Yeah.
So another misstep by Boston 2024.
So I just want to say one small thing about this before we go on to Fitbit, and that is that I mean, this is a large picture issue. It's about Boston, not just over 2024, but Boston over, you know, the next 30 years. And I keep thinking about this because I'm writing about Lincoln and how important it is to kind of think, you know, apart from or beyond the current crisis or issue or controversy or contretemp, and you know, this is a city of great fortitude and resilience, and whatever our very, very, you know, emotionally intense reactions to this right now, this, you know, the city will learn some great things from this and make some very good things of it, including this focused attention on the T in combination with the winter that will no doubt result in a much better public infrastructure.
I certainly hope so.
From the historian standpoint, we move on, and it's a very important moment.
Well, let's get back to the Fitbit. Yeah. I believe it's been around since 2008, I believe I read, which is quite some time. And as many of these stories point out, and as Jim said in the introduction, usually these kind of niche companies like this get quickly subsumed by somebody else, but not yet, at least, for Fitbit. So is there some great lesson to be learned here?
So, you know, Fitbit's interesting for the reasons you folks, both of you, have pointed out in your introductory comments. Founded in, depending on how you date it, 2008, 2007, by two men who are now 38 and 38, James Park and Eric Freeman, based in San Francisco. They have about 600 employees. Going to hit over $1 billion in revenue this year with profit, with lots of profit. Their profit last year was $131 million on $790 million in revenue. So they are very different than most high-tech startups, which go to the public markets, right, or get sold without very much positive income, without operating in the black necessarily at all. What's interesting to me about Fitbit is one, they've emerged out of the pack. So many of our listeners will remember Nike, the Nike band.
Yep.
That was the first one I remember seeing in numbers on people's wrists. It was actually followed then by, I think, Jawbone. In terms, again, this is anecdotal, very, very loosey-goosey research, consumer research, followed by Jawbone. And now there are a number of players in this market. But Fitbit leads the pack, including now the Apple Watch. But Fitbit clearly leads the pack in terms of the units it's selling and the number of people that are registered with Fitbit. How many people are active with these things is a very different measure, because here's Fitbits are and other wearable health monitoring and motion monitoring devices are a little bit like health clubs. We buy them full of verve and resolve, and that dissipates, you know, a little bit like our interest in sticking to a diet very, very intently. And so how many people are actually wearing them, using them, or going way over the top with them? Some of the pieces I read about this were wonderful pieces, including one by a writer for David Sedaris for The New Yorker about, you know, I've done my 30,000 steps. That's a piece of cake. I need to get to 60,000. Now he's at 60,000, and that's considered like a slovenly day.
He says that at the end of that sentence by Sedaris is, and that there will be no end to it until my feet snap off at the ankles.
At the ankles, right. So, and other reports of people who actually put them away because they get so obsessed, they stop enjoying the activity, the walking, the running, and they get competitive with their friends, and then they stop enjoying their friends about how many steps they took. So, you know, taking aside the extremes, it's clearly for the core group of people that are active registered users, which is something around 20 million, this is some, you know, a device of keeping track and ideally motivating you to take more steps and be more active. And that's a very, very important, very, very important kind of part of the market, not just because of, you know, the intensity and the interest in motion, but also because of all these follow-on effects, including obesity and health and disease prevention, that seem to be directly related to motion and moving, including, by the way, these new studies out about the dangers of sitting still. So in some sense, Fitbit is sitting, like these other devices, at the center of several important trends and concerns that could end up paying off very, very big for this company. But as you said, Marjorie, at the very beginning, they run the risk of being a one-trick pony because this is all they make.
Before we get back to the one-trick pony thing, I just wondered, because I don't do the Fitbit thing, but you're a big horseback rider.
Yep.
And people have said in these stories that this woman was a big yogi. She was always running off to yoga class. And does Fitbit account for horseback riding, which is great
it
exercise,
does.
Or
it,
not?
It does. So she had an older Fitbit.
Okay.
The Fitbit I wear is called a Charge HR. I get it because it monitors my heart. And it tells me what my heartbeat is. I don't know why I care, but
I was just going to ask, but I didn't want to.
That would make me nervous.
Exactly.
Well, I have a very, very low heartbeat, so it's kind of interesting to see how low it is.
How low is it?
Resting heartbeat is 51.
Wow.
51. And
you're like a marathon.
So last week, my average resting heartbeat was 51.
Wow.
Yeah, this was a problem I used to have all the time in hospitals because I'd fall off the EKG and the machines would go off thinking I was in cardiac arrest.
Oh, we're really glad we asked Nancy.
That's all right. It's all right. And in any event, I have a Charge HR. It measures all kinds of activity and converts them into steps.
Okay.
So after the horses, 2 hours on my horses, of which I've actually actively worked them for 30 minutes each, it thinks I've walked 5,000 steps.
Okay.
The thing that I'm most interested in here is sort of is an abstract notion is the point that Marjorie made, the sort of one-trick pony, the single product tech company. Because there are a lot of people listening who are entrepreneurial types. They want to invent something. How do I keep ownership of it? How do I not get swallowed up when it's such a good idea that a bigger company decides to do the same thing? And I really still don't get how they survive. Let me give you an example. Yeah. I was in London 6 months ago. My kid was going to school. One of my kids was going to school there for a semester. And my older daughter, who was not going to school there, was wearing a Fitbit. And I didn't want to spend the $100 or $200 because it seemed like fun because we're going to walk much more than we ordinarily do. And I essentially downloaded an app that was a de facto Fitbit. It wasn't quite the same thing. You had to keep it in your pocket.
Keep it in your phone in your pocket.
And it essentially did not all the functions, but the vast majority of functions. It cost me, I think it was $3 or whatever it was. So why have they survived? You know, forget the Apple Watch, which is much higher end. Why have they survived even things as basic as fitness apps, which do perform many of the same functions for far less cost?
A couple of reasons. I think one is actually, to combine both your queries, is about how this is all this does. So that's actually very, very useful if you want to be focused on your motion or you want to be focused
on... That's actually a good point, yeah.
Dear listeners, is you just touch the button and it tells you. So it's 102 and I've walked 5,300 steps, right?
Already today.
Yeah, so that's very
slow. Just look, Nancy's heart rate is 11.
It's 66. But David Sedaris would say, you know, I'm just a couch potato. So... So it's very focused, and I think there's something very useful about that. And the more apps that we collect on our phone, the more we're besieged with all the things technology can do. This is actually really, really simple. You can actually make it more complicated on your phone if you want. But for, I think, most people that are like, you know, oh my God, it's the end of the day. Shall I take the dogs out for a walk? Here's where it matters for me. I'm tired. I'd rather have a Heineken. I look at this. Oh, I'd much rather sit and have a Heineken and watch, you know, Greater Boston, right?
Of course.
We all
feel that way, Nancy.
It's Greater Boston time, which often means it's a Heineken time. And instead I think, gosh, I actually really need to go log another 2,000 steps and take the dogs for a mile walk around the field. So I think the single focus of it is actually very, very helpful. There's a second aspect to it, though. You wear it, it's public. I cannot tell you the number of executives. Yeah. I stand around as the facilitator with, you know, over bubbling water when they're all having, you know, Cabernet or Merlot or Shiraz.
Yeah, Shiraz.
Shiraz. And I'm standing there because I'm going to speak and I can't, so I'm not drinking. And they're all comparing notes their bands. Men and women across genders, very, very kind of, you know, important silverback gorilla banana trading as far as I can tell. So I think that's a piece of this. And then I guess lastly, I would say, I think that it's a way, because it's single, And because you wear it and look at it, it's a way of saying to yourself, this is what I'm up to. A little bit like when you go on a diet and you need to like prominently carry your diet Pepsi around or your bag of carrot sticks. I think there's something self-reinforcing, self-talk and focus that goes on with these things, including the $139 I laid out to buy it. So I think that all
is
of that
is there a monthly fee or is
no,
it just
no
$139
fee, no,
one
no.
time?
No,
$139 is not ridiculous either.
Well, I mean, I don't belong to a health club. That's right. 1 month. That's 1 month's membership at a premium health club. So their customer service department is very good. Anything goes wrong, they basically just replace it. Now, last comment, dear listeners, on the wearability of these. They are all notoriously short-lived. It's a little bit like, you know, when they invented nylon stockings, they invented them originally so they wouldn't run, and that lasted about a year and a half, right? Mm-hmm. And then, you know, DuPont and all the folks making the fibers for nylon said, that's it. We got to create a much more fragile fabric. Same with light bulbs. This mm-hmm. was true at Westinghouse. And Edison was part of that, Thomas Edison. Same thing. These don't last very long. So you're going to
want very long mean? Like 6 months?
Well, if you actually get in the bathtub with them, you know, 2 days.
Okay.
But the straps break, the displays wear out, they just stop syncing well. The sync is when what's actually in here can be displayed on your computer so you can see weekly or talk to friends daily or minute by minute about how active you are. They're just not long-lived. So after a free replacement, you're buying another one, or you're fading out and letting it go. So there's obviously a lot of that happening.
You know, Nancy, you mentioned the New Yorker piece. It was written by David Sedaris, which is a riot. There's another New Yorker piece called "Will Fitbit Go the Way of the Palm Pilot," which gets back to the single product tech firm that Marjorie has mentioned a couple of times. Is there another example of a single product tech firm that comes to mind quickly that has survived, like all of you Nostradamuses or Nostradami are predicting?
That's a good
Fitbit.
Question. That's a good question. I can't think of one right offhand where it's a single functional company, right? Here is what we do and we do nothing else.
Well, you know what? I read one. I take it back. Okay, I read one this morning. GoPro is one. The cameras, obviously, they're huge, and it's run by like an 11-year-old guy who's now multi-billionaire.
Yes. So GoPro. How about Waze? So that's an app. I don't know how they make money, but all they do is GPS, right?
And it is fabulous.
It is fabulous.
If
you haven't downloaded Waze, it is extraordinary. It's all crowdsourcing, by the way. It's a GPS that monitors traffic by virtue of all the people on the road.
And tells you where the police are
secretly
parked on the roads.
And tells you if there's roadkill that may interfere with traffic flow. Great. It's amazing. So that's single. I don't know how they make money, but they're more than surviving.
How do you spell it?
W-A-Z-E.
Thank you.
The coming of free GPS applications put out of business overnight. All those expensive GPS. Remember those GPS machines we were buying and putting on our dashboard? Those all disappeared in a nanosecond.
Like the TomToms, you mean?
Yeah, TomToms. Yeah. They disappeared. So I think we make large kind of sweeping predictions about tech in the digital revolution, in the white heat of the digital revolution, at our peril. All kinds of stuff is changing and happening because, right, the new normal is just turbulence and more turbulence.
So I'm Dave, you are not horseback riding. You are working on a book. Yep. You're doing your teaching. You're doing your speeches, or not speeches, but your trainings mm-hmm. for these executives and stuff. How often do you get to 10,000 steps?
My average is probably, now that my leg is repaired, my average before my leg went down in a horseback riding accident was about 28,000 steps.
So that's a lot of steps.
And remember, I'm writing a book, so I'm sitting a huge amount of time at the computer, and I do not believe you can write and do really good thinking in terms of writing, right, the kind of creative focus thinking you have to do. You can't write and walk on a treadmill. So those treadmill
you
desks.
Correct.
I don't believe it. I've tried them. You cannot think. You cannot get through Lincoln and his depression on walking on the treadmill. You can think about it. You can maybe read about it, but you can't write about it. So I spend a lot of time sitting in my messy big study with books everywhere in Concord, but I'm walking a lot of the other time. Even when I'm facilitating, I'm creating, as one of my colleagues once said, following me, Nancy Kane scorch marks on the carpet because I'm all over the room trying to draw people into the conversation.
I didn't walk 28,000 steps in June. Let me tell you, before you go, you're already in this book about leadership, five figures in history. Lincoln is one. You mentioned when you walked in, the final question we asked Chris Dempsey, leader of the opponents, is he worried about revenge, essentially? By those who say you killed this dream of ours. And you mentioned to Marjorie right before we came back on the air, I've got a great story about revenge in Lincoln. Can you share with us briefly?
I will. I'm driving into the studio, listeners, and I'm listening to Jim's, I thought, trenchant, piercing question. Here's what I thought. I thought it was a great question. I say out loud, it's a great question. I had just finished a section where Lincoln is defeated in 1855 for the U.S. Senate. He would be defeated again in 1858 against Stephen Douglas. And several different people that were on the same general side as he vote against him. He vows not to take any action against them. They will later, by the way, become some of the most important campaign managers at the Chicago Republican Convention, getting him elected. Mm-hmm. And then another interesting point was the person who defeats him, another fellow on the same side of the defining issue in the race, a guy named Lyman Trumbull. There's a victory party held the night after the election, and Lincoln goes, even though he doesn't want to. He's terribly depressed, and the hostess walks up to him and says, "Mr. Lincoln, are you terribly depressed and disappointed?" He says, "Not disappointed enough to shake my friend Trumbull's hand," and he walks up and shakes Trumbull's hand, who will later become another important ally on content and policy for him as president. So may Mr. Fish and the other organizers of 2024 see it from Lincoln's standpoint. This is a small town. Dempsey and Fish and others have a lot in common. Lincoln understood what we deal with is too vast for malice.
Well, that led to Team of Rivals, right?
Too
wasn't that the whole concept?
Vast for
no?
malice.
That's a line from one of his letters in 1862. What I deal
line.
With is too vast for malice. The fate of Boston, the problems we have and the opportunities we have are too vast for malice and revenge over this.
Can I
hear,
tell you
hear that, Jim?
Malice is all it keeps me going every single day. I don't understand this concept at all. Nancy, okay. It's great to see you.
Thank you very much, Nancy Kane, who joins us every Tuesday for Open Mic. She's an historian at the Harvard Business School, where she holds a James E. Robeson Chair of Business Administration. Her latest book, But Not For Long, is Ernest Shackleton Exploring Leadership. Thank you so much, Nancy. We're going to talk Olympics again in about 20 minutes or so. But in the interim, backed by popular demand, Paul Solman and Larry Kotlikoff are here to take your calls on how to get the biggest bang from your Social Security bucks and you 20-somethings to tell you whether it's going to still be around when you need it to retire. That's next on 89.7 WGBH Boston Public Radio.